Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Welcome to the best of Connecting Faith. This previously aired encore presentation features some of our most compelling conversations at noon on Faith Radio.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Glad to have you tuned in. I always appreciate the opportunity to get together and spend a little time with you as we go through important conversations about things that really matter. And the bottom line is that we help connect faith to life. So how do we apply biblical principles to daily life situation? I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross at the controls. And Ted, I think today's topic will be one of those application kind of shows.
That's good. We need that.
Well, this
connecting
is,
faith to life.
Is
what
well,
we
that's right. And this is, we're going to hear about, the wisest fool in the Bible.
Hmm.
Now, when we think about the wise in the Bible, we think of Solomon. Well, our guest has written a book called The Solomon Seduction and what we can learn from the wisest fool in the Bible, because he was one of those people, and you've probably met them, people that were extremely intelligent and really made foolish decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And thought, you know, they've got a lot of brains, but not a lot of wisdom, maybe.
And sadly, you know, we see news stories covering the most prominent leaders that fall. I mean, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And then that makes us as Christians look like hypocrites.
Yeah.
And it's hard to shine the light in those circumstances.
You know, if you've ever had one of those moments to go, you know, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
So thinking that, you know, 300 concubines would be good if you only had 700 wives. No, I don't think so. No.
Solomon.
So we were, you know, it won't just be about that, but there's a lot more to it. And we'll get to today's guest in a moment, who is our pastor, by the way. And I do want to mention that we are in the midst of our October Clergy Pastor Appreciation Month celebration. And we've got a great opportunity for pastors, because during this month, you have an opportunity to nominate your pastor to receive a week-long getaway to Sunscapes Retreats. If you remember last year, we had this this great offering, and we're bringing it back again, myfaithradio.com. And you can honor your pastor by nominating them for a Sunscape Retreat. It's a time for them and their spouse to rest and recharge. And you can get details online, myfaithradio.com. I know, Ted, you traveled in ministry for a number of years. I mean, a retreat can really make a complete difference.
It really does. I mean, when you're going day after day, I mean, because to be honest, let's be real, pastors are on call 24/7.
That's
true.
And
they call in the middle of the night for different circumstances to go by the bedside of a sick person or somebody really struggling. And so to get that break, that sabbatical, can really be life-changing, life-giving for them, to refuel them. For us, we were traveling in Europe on a music ministry team, and we had 10 days off in the middle. And it was nice because of the location. So we got to do a little European tour right there from our ministry opportunities, and went to Venice and, you know, all those nice places.
Sure.
So that was a nice rest. But we came back, though, ready to go, ready to hit the road and kind of refueled.
Well, this is the month when we should be appreciating our pastors every month, of course.
But this
is a month where we particularly focus on that. And I hope that in addition to encouraging your pastor with a note or a card or phone call or email, that you'll also sign them up for this great opportunity. So go to myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And we've got details right on the front page there. It's a great week from Sunscapes Retreat in Colorado. That'll be an exciting time. So I just encourage you to check that out, myfaithradio.com. And so we're ready to learn a few things from the wisest fool. Ted, what do you think?
Let's get into it.
All right. Here we go with today's Connecting Faith. Mark Atterbury to you. He's an award-winning author of 11 books, been the preaching minister at Poinciana Christian Church in Kissimmee, Florida since 1989. And I think I pronounced both those right. Did I, Mark, did I get, it's Poinciana, isn't it?
You did very well.
And
you got
Kissimmee.
Just exactly right.
I can't tell you how many times it's taken me to get Kissimmee right, but that was...
Well, we call it Kissimmee during the day and Kissimmee at night.
Sure.
But since this is midday, we'll go
with
Kissimmee.
Sure, okay. And, I was just telling you before we started the program, so we had a day here not long ago when it was 85 and humid, and I thought, this would just be a pleasant evening in Kissimmee. But,
right now you could add about 10 degrees to that and 100% humidity, and you'd have our weather.
Mm. Well, we're glad that you're there and connecting with us by phone, and we're going to talk today about one of the books you've written. You've written a number of books. In fact, I was just looking at some of the lists you've written about Caleb and about Samson, and this one about Solomon. And is this something that sort of has come out of just your preaching series as you've focused on some of these important characters in the Bible?
Actually, no. A lot of authors who are also preachers will do a sermon series and then turn it into a book, and I think that's a great way to do it. For some reason, I've never been able to do that. I'm not sure what's wrong with me, but I've always written the book first and then preached it. And so I kind of do it backwards. I'm not sure if there's any deeper meaning in there or what, but I basically write my books out of the needs that I perceive and see in the people that I work with every day. And so when I wrote about Samson 10 years ago, I saw guys struggling with some of the issues that Samson struggled with. And I don't know, in my thinking, a book was born, and I started writing, and Thomas Nelson was kind enough to publish it. When I wrote the Caleb book, I saw people struggling with their dreams and the disappointment that they had when their dreams didn't come true. And I thought, wow, this is a guy in the Bible who really teaches us how to dream and how to chase our dreams. So a book was born. And now, with Solomon, I see so much seduction in the world, so many people being seduced, and the people I work with every day, the members of our church and the people I encounter in the community, so many people struggling. And it just struck me that it's a topic that needed to be addressed. And so my books really come out of the needs and the problems and the struggles I see in the people around me, and it's really not any more complicated than that.
We want to define what we mean by seduction in a moment and kind of go through some of the great insights in the book. But maybe to start out with, we were joking at the beginning about the OIM, O-I-M. So who is an O-I-M?
Well,
why does he make foolish decisions?
That stands for the Otherwise Intelligent Male. And I coined that little idea in the book because that's really what Solomon was, and it's what so many men are today. I mean, we're talking about guys who may have college degrees. They may be very successful in business. They may be highly respected in certain areas of their lives, but then they turn around and do really dumb things. And that really kind of summarizes Solomon's story. You know, he was a person who'd been given the gift of wisdom, and God had blessed him in so many ways. He had everything in front of him that he needed to be successful. I mean, it was set up for him. I mean, he just, it's almost unthinkable that he could have messed it up, but he did. And we see that in guys' lives today. You know, guys who are otherwise very intelligent, they get into certain areas of life, maybe in their relationships or in their finances or whatever, and they just make these incredibly dumb mistakes. And so that's really part of what the book addresses, is how does an otherwise intelligent man get into a situation where he's making horrible choices?
Yeah, we can all probably think of one or two, maybe close friends, or certainly people in the news that we hear about, and you go, what were they thinking?
And that is the common question we often ask. And my wife and I, kind of jokingly, when we're watching the news, we'll see a report about somebody who's just done something incredibly dumb, and we'll look at each other and almost simultaneously say, the Solomon seduction. You know, it's there it is again. It crops up time and time and time and time again, almost daily, really. You can look around and see an otherwise intelligent person doing something crazy.
Now, you know, isn't wisdom more than intelligence? I guess I'm wondering, I mean, shouldn't Solomon sort of had a better grip on, you know, some of the seductions that that waylaid him? Maybe talk about, you know, defining wisdom and intelligence, or does it really matter?
Yeah, that's a good point. There was a time when God offered to give Solomon anything he wanted. He said, you just ask for something, anything, and I'll give it to you. And, of course, Solomon could have asked for wealth. He could have asked for fame or riches, whatever. But he asked for wisdom. And he said that he wanted wisdom so that he would be able to lead God's people well. And God was just completely pleased with that answer. That's, I think, what God was hoping to hear. And so God says, well, I'm going to give you wisdom, and I'm going to give you wealth and fame as well. And so here Solomon is as about a 20-year-old king with wisdom. Now, I believe wisdom and discernment are synonyms. And if we wanted to define those things, I would say basically it's the ability to see through to the heart of an issue. Discernment, wisdom, you're able to see things as they really are. You're able to understand what's really happening so that when somebody's trying to deceive you or when a situation looks confusing, you're able to really see through to the heart of what's really going on and make the right decision. So that is what God gave to Solomon. He didn't just give him intelligence. You know, he didn't just give him the ability to make straight A's in school. He gave him the ability to weigh issues and to see through to the heart of complex problems and to find the real truth, the real answer in the middle of all that. And so, yes, Solomon should have done better. There's no excuse for him to have done the things he did, but we can't be too hard on him, because most of us can look in a mirror and say that we've done some of the same things, and maybe not with such catastrophic results as what Solomon suffered, but most of us have done things that we knew were wrong and would be devastating, but we did them anyway.
Mm-hmm. Talking today with Mark Atterbury about Solomon's seduction, what you can learn from the wisest fool in the Bible. So if we've got a definition of wisdom and discernment, then let's define seduction. What do we mean by seduction?
Seduction is the art, and I want to stress that word, it is the art of enticing someone to make negative behavioral choices that he or she would not otherwise make. Now, the reason I call it an art is because, you know, if it's a science, there's a certain formula, and you just go by that formula, and it works every time. But seduction is an art because no two people are alike. And so what works on one person might not work on someone else. And Satan understands this. He understands we're all different. He understands we all have different weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And so he, you know, he tailors his temptations to meet each person's individual vulnerability or weakness. And, you know, the first seduction in history happened at the beginning of Genesis, when the serpent approached Eve and said, hey, look at this fruit, man. You don't realize what this fruit will do for you. And so she, of course, tasted it. And then the second seduction happened perhaps a few minutes later when she turned to her husband and said, oh, baby, you got to try this. This is great. And so from then on, really throughout history, people have been seducing and being seduced. And we have all kinds of seducers in the Bible. We have Jacob, who seduced his brother Esau to get his birthright. We have Potiphar's wife, who was a seducer, and she approached Joseph, and of course she didn't succeed, but we get the feeling there that she was an expert seducer, seductress. We have Delilah, who seduced Samson. We have David, who seduced Bathsheba. So there's tons of seduction in the Bible and throughout history. What happened with Solomon, he's probably the greatest, maybe the most famous victim of seduction of all, because he had such, he was so prepared and so equipped to resist. And I think maybe he fell farther than some of these other people because of the gift of wisdom that God had given him. And it's what makes his story so interesting, because we think when we read his story, well, if this could happen to him, it could certainly happen to any of us. And so it's kind of a scary thing when you think about it, the potential that any of us have to fall prey to seduction.
Stay with us. More of the best of Connecting Faith is on the way in just moments. We're back now to the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired Encore presentation.
That musical reminder is, if you know the lyric, it's "Open the eyes of my heart, Lord, I want to see you." The fact is that Sometimes we go through life with our eyes maybe half open or maybe purposely closed because we are walking down a path that we know isn't going to lead us anywhere good. And we're talking about some of the lessons we can learn from the wisest man in the Bible, the wisest man who ever lived. The Solomon Seduction is the name of the book, the subtitle, What You Can Learn from the Wisest Fool in the Bible. It's from Mark Atterbury, and it's published by Thomas Nelson. Mark's written several books that will help us as guys, particularly on how we can live in life that is pleasing to the Lord. I know that, Mark, as you've talked about some of the basics, you said, you know, it's sort of different for everybody. But there are some, maybe a few, maybe standard tricks that the enemy likes to use. I thought maybe we should just review some of those. You describe it, I think, as sort of lipstick on the pig, right? It's still, we still know what's behind that lipstick.
Yeah, they say you can put lipstick on a pig, but, you know, it's still a pig. And Satan, what he'll do in his effort to seduce guys, he'll put a little lipstick on there. He'll dress sin up and try to make it look better. And now it's still ugly underneath. It's still sin, still rotten. It'll still destroy you. But if he can make it look a little better and a little more enticing, lots of times guys will give in. And so let's just list a few of these lipsticks. One of them is alcohol. And if you think, I mean, like on the news, when you watch the news at night and you see some mugshot on there of some guy who's stabbed his friend or shot his girlfriend or whatever he's done, crazy, insane thing he's done, often there will be an alcohol angle to the story. You know, they've been all night out at a bar or they've been drinking or something. It's just incredible how alcohol makes horrible things look attractive. And so many people get into trouble because of alcohol. Another one Satan uses, a lipstick that he puts on the pig, is privacy. You know, if you think the main fear most people have concerning sin is getting caught. And so if Satan can take that away, and if he can make you feel confident that you won't get caught, then suddenly that sin becomes much more enticing. And, you know, we're talking about pornography, for example. You know, if you can look at porn and your wife doesn't know and she can't find out, well, then it's a lot easier for you to give in to that temptation. We have, unfortunately, like most large cities, we have, you know, strip clubs in the Orlando area. And I'm always amused at how they're set up. You know, they're sitting there on the road. They got all the flashing lights. But the parking lots are always in the rear, and they always have a fence around them. And, of course, the idea is that if you're a guy who wants to go there, you can park in the back. Nobody will see your car. You can sneak in. You can sneak out. Nobody will know. And that's lipstick on the pig. That's giving you the promise of privacy, which makes the sin that much more enticing. Another one is a financial benefit. You know, let's say you're in business and you're in sales. And maybe by stretching the truth a little bit, maybe by manipulating some things, you can sell more, make more money. It's unethical, but there's that promise of financial reward that makes the temptation that much harder to resist. Another one, and I think this is where Solomon ran into trouble. Another lipstick Satan uses is popular opinion. You know, when doing something makes you popular, when doing something makes people respect you or like you, the temptation becomes much more enticing. For example, Solomon, you know, the first big mistake he made was marrying the king of Egypt's daughter. And he wasn't supposed to do that. The Bible, the Old Testament law says don't intermarry with pagan tribes. You know, he wasn't supposed to do that. But he knew that by doing it, he could win the people's respect and the respect of the other kings in the area to show them that he was a guy who knew how business was done. He knew how the game was played. And by making an alliance with the king of Egypt, he could establish himself as a player on the world stage. And so it was popular opinion. It was the trying to impress people that led him into his first big mistake. Another lipstick that Satan uses is moderation. You know, he convinced you that as long as you don't get carried away, you know, you can drink as long as you don't drink too much. You know, you can fool around in the back seat of the car as long as you don't go all the way. You know, moderation, knowing when to stop. But, of course, we know what happens. You get involved in something and you tell yourself you're not going to go too far. But in the heat of the moment, a lot of times you lose your judgment and you end up doing the very thing you said you weren't going to do. And then the last one I list in the book is peer participation. And I think this is important for Christians to think about. Peer pressure is when your peers are pressuring you to do something. They're trying to talk you into it. Peer participation is when you just look around and see your peers doing it. And so you think because they do it and they're Christians, you can do it too. And so that's why I'm very careful as a pastor about the places I go and what I drink when I'm in a restaurant or anywhere, just because I don't want people to see me doing something and then think, well, if he does it, then it's okay for me to do it. And maybe it isn't, you know. So there's all kinds of ways. What I think this does is it impresses upon us the challenge that we're talking about today. Because Satan has a lot of weapons. Satan has a lot of stuff he can do to trick us and to suck us in to sin. And as Christians, we've got to understand that. We've got to prepare for that. We've got to be in the Word. We've got to equip ourselves to be able to resist what he's trying to do to us.
I think you describe it as Satan's sort of like the ultimate cat burglar. He's picking locks. And,
yeah,
you know, that
sure.
We think that we're protected, but we're not necessarily.
Well, you know, a burglar, if he wants to break into a store, you know, he's not going to put dynamite down and blow a hole in the wall. He's going to pick the lock and try to get in unnoticed. And I think that's a good analogy of how Satan operates. Most of us as Christians, we're not going to fall for a full-on frontal assault. You know, we're going to – anything that Satan does that is dramatic, we're going to recognize it and we're going to say, oh, I don't want to do that. But where we get in trouble is Satan picks the lock. He comes into our lives quietly, without a lot of fanfare, sneaks in maybe just through a little crack that we've left open, and the first thing you know, we're in trouble. We're doing things we shouldn't be doing. And sometimes we look back and we wondered, how did that happen? You know, how did I let myself get into this place? And it happened because it was very quiet and very subtle.
And what we need, and we're going to get to as we go along in the second half of the show, some of those wake-up calls, because it is quiet. We need to wake up. And I guess that's maybe the first thing. Just because we have wisdom or discernment doesn't necessarily mean that it's all going to we're in the clear, right?
You know, life is such that we all have so much stuff going on. We're busy. I mean, we've got families, we've got jobs, we've got responsibilities every day that we have to take care of. It's so easy for things to slip in. You know, you can be so distracted with life, and I'm saying you can be distracted with good things. You know, if you've got two or three kids and you've got a job, and you know, you're doing good things. But still, you may not be paying attention to every little area of your life, and the first thing you know, you can start to slip.
Let's find out how we can avoid some of those areas where we slip, where we could get seduced. It's not all about women, although we're certainly going to talk about that here, because Solomon clearly had a little issue there, times 10 or whatever. My goodness. Anyway, so we'll discuss that and more. In just a couple of minutes with Mark Atterbury as we talk about his book, The Solomon Seduction, What You Can Learn from the Wisest Fool in the Bible, is from Thomas Nelson. Mark is a pastor in the Kissimmee, Florida area, and a popular speaker and a workshop leader, and has written a number of books, including The Caleb Quest, What You Can Learn from the Boldest Dreamer in the Bible, The Samson Syndrome, What You Can Learn from the Baddest Boy in the Bible, and now The Solomon Seduction. Well, he's written several others as well, but a great insight there, easy to read. And we'll get to more with Mark in a moment.
Thanks for being with us for this encore presentation of The Best of Connecting Faith. We're back with more in just a moment.
Better wise up,
Welcome back to an encore presentation of the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired program.
You know, if Mark was a songwriter, he'd probably write that song. Instead, he's an author, and he wrote The Solomon Seduction. I know he plays instrumental. He loves to play music, part of his worship team at church, in fact.
Yep.
They let you in. So, yep. Of course, you are the pastor. I suppose you'd know.
Well, when you're the senior pastor, you have some extra pull. Yeah.
We're talking about one of his recent books called The Solomon Seduction, What You Can Learn from the Wisest Fool in the Bible. And as the press information says, it seems impossible that the valedictorian of the entire human race would ruin his life by making dumb choices, but Solomon did. And you think about it, you know, he truly was the wisest man in the Bible, and yet let's start with the wives and concubines. What was he thinking?
Oh, this is one of my favorite parts of the whole story. And I think, you know, for guys anyway, when you mention Solomon and you start thinking about him, I mean, that's where your mind goes immediately, because it is just so hard to wrap your head around having 700 wives and 300 concubines. Let me give you a little some stats. 700 wives, that's more wives than there are players in the NBA. That's more wives than there are Red Lobster restaurants in the entire world. That's more wives than there are ships in the U.S. Navy. That's more wives than there are commercial airports in the entire United States of America. With the concubines, you've got 1,000 women. That would be enough to make 27 sets of Radio City Music Hall Rockettes, all for one guy. I don't know about you, but I can't wrap my head around that.
No.
You know, I think the application here, we got to be careful with it, because none of us guys are ever going to have 1,000 women, you know, to deal with. We're never going to have even two wives. But what we might have, if we're not careful, we might fall into the trap of having multiple relationships going at the same time. And I'm talking about adultery. I'm talking about cheating on the person that you're in your committed relationship with, whether you're dating and you're engaged or you're married. A lot of guys make the mistake of having an affair. And I think really that's the application here, not the 700 to 1,000. It's easy to get distracted by those extreme numbers. But it's the second female in your life, you know, that you have to be wary of. That woman at work that you think is cute and seems to think you're attractive and flirts with you during the breaks and the lunch hours, I think that's where the real danger is. And so for all of us, we've got to understand that Satan uses relationships. He uses sexual temptation to bring us down. And it certainly worked with Solomon. It worked with his father, David. It worked with a lot of people, Samson and others. But it's one of the primary pitfalls that we have to deal with today, because we live in such a sexually active society where there's stimuli all around us all the time. And the temptation is always there. And unless you live in a cave, you know, if you get out in the public eye and at work and things, there are always going to be females out there, and the temptation is always going to be there.
Well, we certainly there's plenty of examples and certainly plenty of warnings, you know, statistics or whatever. I mean, I was just wondering, is it because we live in a society that is so overwarned these days that we kind of just don't pay attention to it? Or I mean, are most of these situations where we know what to do, we choose not to?
I think that's a part of it. We are so numbed to the warnings. I mean, I do think that's part of it. But I also think part of it is that as guys, we think more highly of ourselves than we should. We have more confidence in our own ability or in our own strength or in our own wisdom and mental abilities than what we should have. You know, sometimes that's really what it boils down to, is overconfidence. You know, well, we say, I would never do something like that. You know, I would never make that mistake. I love my wife. I would never step out on her. I mean, so many men, I think, have had that attitude only to wake up one day and realize that they did the very thing they thought they would never do. And I think, you know, they say, well, he's not that kind of guy, or I'm not that kind of guy. I think every guy is that kind of guy. You know, if you let your guard down, I mean, if you look at David, who was the man after God's own heart, and what he did with Bathsheba, and then in subsequent to that, you know, having her husband killed and all that sort of thing, if the man after God's own heart could do something like that, I think any of us could do it. So I think overconfidence is part of that. We probably are a little numb. I mean, you know, when I think about it, I'm 58 years old. When I think about how many sermons I've heard in my life and how many I've preached myself and how many Bible studies I've sat through, I mean, no telling how many sermons I've heard on adultery or any kind of sin you can mention. So, yeah, I've heard it all 1,000 times. So have you. So is everybody listening to this program, probably. But that doesn't really mean anything if you're not conscious day-to-day, moment-by-moment, of what's going on around you. If you let your guard down, if you think more highly of yourself than you should, then you're a prime candidate for seduction.
I was thinking, you use the word overconfidence, and of course we got the All-Star game going on here, festivities here in the Upper Midwest and the Target Field, and so we can maybe talk about ego, because that would be a shorter way to say overconfidence, I guess, many times.
Oh, yeah, and Solomon is the classic example of a guy with a big ego. Let me give you this little stat, and this will kind of sum it up for you. Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem, famous for building the temple. He also built a palace for himself. So he built a house for God, and he built a house for himself. It took him 7 years to build God's house. It took him, are you ready for this? 13 years to build his own house. Now, I don't know about you, but I would think that's an indicator that there's some ego there. When it takes you almost twice as long to build your own house as it does to build God's house, obviously you think pretty highly of yourself. Another thing is, it's kind of an interesting little thing you can dig out of the scriptures if you're really looking at the details. But at the dedication speech that Solomon gave for the temple, I mean, the thing is built, it's God's house, and now they're having this big ceremony, and they're praising, and they're praying, and they're singing, and whatever. And Solomon speaks, like the dedication message at the temple, 6 times in that message, he said these words, I have built. I have built. Now, I don't know how many people were involved in the building of that temple, but I would say probably thousands. And yet Solomon got up and took credit for the whole thing himself. I mean, this was a guy whose ego was out of control. And that, I think, is a huge part of what got him in trouble. He thought more highly of himself than he should have. He thought he was invincible. I mean, life for him was all about him. And it is no surprise then that he crashed, because that's what happens to people who aren't humble and don't see weakness in themselves.
Talking about the Solomon seduction and what we can learn from the wisest fool in the Bible. That's the title of the new book from Mark Atterbury. Mark's pastor and author of a number of books. Talking to us from Kissimmee, Florida today. You're welcome to join our conversation at 877-93-FAITH. Or if you'd prefer to send us a question online, you can do that as well, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Then click on the Connecting Faith show page, and you can get the email link there and send us a note, a question. Maybe just tell a little bit about your story, your experiences, or maybe just a question or two about some of the dangers that come in when we are seduced. One of the areas that you address is that wake-up call number 5. You know you're being seduced when sin management seems like a better choice than repentance. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite chapters, because I think it's really a problem for a lot of people. And I admit there have been times in my own life when it's been a problem for me. But let's say you have a garage that is a mess. And by the way, who doesn't? And so you want to deal with this garage. Well, you've got 3 choices. You know, you can ignore it and just let it remain a mess. You can kind of straighten it up, you know, reorganize it, move some things around. Or you can clean it out, throw the junk away and really create some space in that garage for to make it really a more functional garage. Well, the only choice number two really or choice number three really accomplishes anything, because if you ignore it, obviously you don't accomplish anything. If you just rearrange the contents, I mean, it might look better, but it's not really functionally any better because all the junk is still in there. Well, this is what people do with their lives. You know, we look at our lives. Let's say we've got a mess. You're into something that you shouldn't be doing. You're involved in some sort of sin pattern. So you can either ignore it, or you can kind of just arrange your life so that your sin is better hidden. People won't notice it. Or you can truly repent and get rid of your sin. Now, Solomon's mistake was that he never really repented of his sin. He rearranged things in his life to make his sin not as noticeable. And I can give you one quick example. When he married the king of Egypt's daughter, he violated the Mosaic law, clearly. Everybody knew it. All of a sudden, he had this Egyptian woman walking around the palace. And the people were looking at this situation, and they were saying, whoa, our king just married an Egyptian girl. That's a no-no. He's not supposed to do that. So Solomon was getting some bad press. So what he should have done, he should have cleaned out the closet. He should have repented. He should have sent the young woman back to her father in Egypt. But what he did was, the Bible tells us, he built her a separate residence out in an out-of-the-way place, to get her out of the main palace where she wouldn't be seen. See, he wasn't cleaning out the closet. He was just rearranging things a little bit. And I think that was the turning point in his life. If he had truly repented of that sin and sent that young woman back to her father in Egypt, I think he would have been well on his way to living a whole different kind of life. But because he chose to hang on to the sin and just hide it a little better, I think that set him on a track now where he's going to continue to make bad choices all the way along. And that's really what it boils down to for all of us. When we realize we're off track, what are we going to do? Are we going to repent? Or are we just going to try to manage our sin better so that it doesn't embarrass us, or that people can't see what's really going on in our lives? That is one of the most critical questions that every person has to deal with.
I'm sure as a pastor over the years, you've counseled lots of folks who have been very good at compartmentalizing, right?
And say, absolutely.
Well, that's rationalizing, compartmentalize, whatever it is.
Well, one of the illustrations I give in the book, and this is true to life in my experience, we had a neighbor who would not smoke in his house. He would always go outside and smoke. And so he would smoke, and he'd smoke, and he'd smoke, and he'd smoke, but never in the house. And I assume the reason he didn't want to smoke in the house is that he didn't want to get his furniture and his carpet and his draperies all stinky to smell like smoke. So he kept, he managed it. You know, he kept the smoke out of his house, but he still died of cancer. And I think the illustration there, or the truth there in that story, is that you can manage your sin and you can keep it away from certain things and you can keep it, bottled up and compartmentalized, whatever, but it's still going to get you. There's still going to be some damaging effects of sin. That's just the way it is. You know, the wages of sin is death. And you can manage it and manage it and manage it, but it's still going to get you. You need to repent of it.
Mark Atterbury is my guest. We're talking about the Solomon seduction, and in a moment we'll talk about the importance of trusted advisors and close friends, and maybe you have someone in your life who you can see as being seduced, not very discerning, and you want to learn some lessons. Stay tuned for that, an answer or two there. Mark Atterbury, pastor and author of the book, The Solomon Seduction, What You Can Learn from the Wisest Fool in the Bible. It's a timely information coming your way here on Connecting Faith.
Back now to the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired Encore presentation.
We're talking about the kind of friends that we associate with as we focus in on the important part of wise advisors to avoid seductions. and the enemy's attacks, and how to be discerning and allow others to speak into our lives. Talking to Mark Atterbury today, award-winning author of 11 books. He's been the preaching minister at Point Siena Christian Church in Kissimmee, Florida, since 1989, a popular speaker and writer. And the one we're referencing today is called The Solomon Seduction. It's from Thomas Nelson. So, Mark, let's talk a little bit about wise advisors. I mean, Solomon certainly would have had plenty of wise advisors. And, of course, we know that we can think of government leaders, ministry leaders, all were surrounded, it seems like, by competent people.
Well, he had advisors. I'm not sure how wise they are or were. They probably seemed to be wise. I'm sure they had earned their way into the positions that they held. They probably had reputations for being wise men. But when the chips were down, you know, whenever it really came down to a critical moment, they failed. And again, what I'm referring to is Solomon's first big foreign policy decision, which he made at about the age of 20 or 21. He was a new king, the king of Egypt. Most scholars think the king of Egypt approached him with an alliance opportunity, a treaty, and Solomon had to decide if he was going to make that treaty, sign that treaty, and accept the king of Egypt's daughter to be his wife. Now, I have to believe that he would have sat down with his cabinet. I mean, he was a head of state. All heads of state then and now, they all have cabinets, they all have advisors, they all have people around them. And I have to believe that Solomon sat down with these guys and said, what should I do? This is my first big decision. And I think it's clear that his advisors said, hey, Solomon, you got to do this. Man, this is a great opportunity. It's an opportunity for you to establish yourself on the world stage as a leader to be reckoned with. It shows the other kings in the area that you know how the game is played. You've got to do this. And so Solomon did it, and then everything goes downhill from there. Yeah, he had people in his life who probably had good reputations, as I said, but they were not good friends and advisors to Solomon. And in fact, we have no record, really, of anyone in Solomon's inner circle who ever said to him, hey, Solomon, you need to rethink what you're doing here. Now, we know the King Hiram of Tyre did that for him, but, I mean, he was another king in another country. They were just friends, and Hiram did mention to Solomon that something has happened to you. You're not the same guy you used to be. But among Solomon's inner circle, his own people, his own advisors, there's no record that any of them ever pulled him aside and said, hey, you're off track. Boy, I tell you, I think there's a lesson there. We all need people around us who love us enough and are courageous enough to tell us the truth, even if the truth hurts. I think about some of the other great characters in the Bible, like Samson, for example. Again, we never see Samson with a close friend. We never see him with someone to hold him accountable. Same thing with Solomon. He had friends around him. He had advisors, but no one ever held him accountable for his actions. And I don't care who you are. You know, you could be Solomon, you, me, anybody. We all need to be held accountable sooner or later. We all come to that moment when we're about to make a terrible choice. And somebody needs to be in our orbit who can say, hey, whoa, don't do this. You're making a mistake.
Can that be a spouse? I mean, it's difficult sometimes if you're, you know, maybe you're just coming with suspicions of whatever it might be.
I think it can be a spouse. I think probably it'd be better to be someone else because, I mean, marriage is not supposed to work this way, but I think because we live in a fallen world, sometimes it does work this way, that husbands and wives, after a certain number of years being married, they kind of tune each other out. I'm not saying every marriage is that way, but I think a lot of them are. Let's put it this way. I've done enough marriage counseling over the years to know that a lot of couples tune each other out. And so there's that issue that would have to be overcome. But I think I advise, when I do seminars and stuff for guys, I always encourage guys to find a friend, an accountability partner that you can trust, that you can be open with, and challenge that person to hold you accountable if they ever see you getting off track.
Well, let's talk about one of the kind of the heart of the matter. As you talk about one of the wake-up calls, is and the, it was a great visual illustration saying, you know, the throne of your heart is not a sofa or a sectional. It's not a love seat. There's not more than one chair there.
Well, yeah, you know, many of Solomon's wives were pagan. They brought idols with them into the relationship. And, of course, idolatry, you know, having multiple gods is a major no-no in Scripture. God said in the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me. Nevertheless, Solomon began worshiping these pagan idols, began building altars to them. That, to me, is just unthinkable. I can't hardly even imagine how Solomon, this man who was so tight with God at one time, could actually be building altars to these pagan gods on the hills around Jerusalem. But I think that's really the ultimate sign that you're being seduced, is when your love and your devotion is no longer just for God. And in fact, God really slips into the background of your life. And there are other things that become more important to you. And I don't think that probably anybody listening to this program right now is ever going to bow down and worship a statue. Could happen, I guess, but probably not. However, there are things in our lives that can become more important to us than God. And that idea that the throne of your heart, I mean, it's a one-seater. You know, there's only room for one person, one entity on the throne of your heart, and that is God. He belongs there. The problem is we trade in the one-seater for a, you know, a love seat, and then we trade in the love seat for a sectional sofa. We got, the first thing you know, we got five or six gods in our lives, and that is, well, that's just a disaster when that happens. Even if you're weak, and even if you make mistakes, you still have to understand that there's only one God, and if you can get, you know, if you can make that your priority, to serve only the living, the true God, you may make some mistakes along the way, but you can always come back. However, once God slips into the background and you get all these substitutes, then you're really in trouble.
Is there a, maybe a step or two, or the maybe the best defense, what we can do today that's going to, that will help us get back on the right track to avoiding, or to at least increase in our discernment?
Well, Proverbs 4:23, Solomon himself said, "Guard your heart above all else, for it determines the course of your life." And you know, it's funny to read the book of Proverbs and see all these wonderful statements that Solomon made that he then turned around and violated. So there's that, you know, kind of sort through that. It's kind of a strange thing. But I think what he said there in Proverbs 4:23, that you have to guard your heart because it's going to determine everything in your life. I think that's the key to it. And if I've been asked before, if you had to sum up this book or the challenge of this book in one statement or one sentence, what would it be? And I think that's it. And it's never too late to start guarding your heart. And that's the hope I would offer to anybody who's listening to this broadcast and who maybe has really gotten themselves messed up, is it's never too late to start guarding your heart. Maybe you haven't guarded it in the past, and maybe it's led you into some terrible choices, and you may be suffering for those choices. But you can start today. It's never too late. As long as you're alive, as long as you're breathing, as long as you have your mental faculties, it is never too late to repent of your sin and get right with God.
It's hard to find anything to add to that. I mean, that is the message that we gladly proclaim here day after day here in Faith Radio. So, Mark, thank you for doing that. It does make you wonder, I guess, you think about Solomon, you know, what it says about our human condition, that, you know, the wisest man even had so many foibles, and you read through Ecclesiastes and you go, there was a lot of vanity and foolishness in his life.
Yeah, the book of Ecclesiastes really should be mentioned, because most scholars think it was written during the last 4 to 5 years of his life, and it kind of gives us the idea that Solomon did come back to his senses. He did get right with God. He did sort things out, and so that's encouraging. But boy, there were a lot of wasted years in there. But I think, too, we have to remember that we serve a loving God, who is full of grace. God's grace is greater than our sin. God's grace is greater than Solomon's sin, is greater than our sin. And, of course, that grace comes to us through Jesus Christ. And that is the ultimate answer I would throw out there to anybody right now who has been seduced by the world is, okay, fine, you've made some mistakes, you've done some terrible things, but Jesus Christ is the answer to that problem. And through his blood, he can wash away those sins, and you can start fresh. And I mean really fresh. You can be born again. You can start fresh with a clean slate, and you can do better the next time around and guard your heart and not make these same mistakes.
Amen. Thanks to Mark Atterbury for a wonderful word of encouragement. The whole hour as we've talked today about the Solomon seduction, what you can learn from the wisest fool in the Bible. It's from Thomas Nelson. Mark is a pastor in Kissimmee, Florida, and he's written a number of books. You can find out more about him. It's markatterbury.net. Isn't that what it is?
Well, no, it's actually a little stronger everyday.com.
If you missed a portion of today's program or would like to hear it again or pass it on to a friend, you can go to our website to catch the podcast. It's myfaithradio.com. Then click on Connecting Faith. Myfaithradio.com. Click on Connecting Faith for the podcast.
And this has been an encore presentation of the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk with you again soon.